broke the old record of 88, which was set back in 1968. It was a very unusually warm air mass.
Hot weather fuels fires across the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 9th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Fairbanks City Council passes a controversial ordinance to tackle the city's chronic inebriate problem.
That's not something that government can simply willy-nilly publish in the domain without incurring some potential liability.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A high-pressure system over south-central Alaska is to blame for heavy smoke blanketing the Anchorage and Matanuska Valley areas. The system is trapping smoke from interior fires over the population centers. Meanwhile, much farther north, residents of historic McCarthy are noticing a lot of smoke in the air, too. Tacy Skinner is a public information officer for the National Park Service in McCarthy.
Well, there's 71 active fires in Alaska right now.
She says the smoke is from interior fires. Most of the interior fires were started by lightning. The biggest fire, the Minto Flats South Fire, north of Indiana, has grown to about 134,000 acres. About 200 firefighters are on the scene. The fire threatens 49 cabins and a drilling rig. Managers say high clouds have slowed the fire's growth, giving firefighters a chance to try to protect some of the cabins before hotter weather returns this weekend. They expect the fire could expand dramatically again when that happens. Skinner says a fire now burning about 12 miles from McCarthy is in no danger of reaching the town. The Chanika fire is roughly 7,000 acres. A town meeting will be held in McCarthy tonight as fire personnel from the National Park Service and Alaska Division of Forestry continue to gather information about structures and historical sites in the fire's vicinity. Skinner says the fire has been burning for 3 days.
There's a lot of beetle kill there, and so it's getting rid of a lot of the dead and downed trees. It's good for the habitat. It'll increase the habitat for the wildlife populations.
Yesterday was the hottest day in Fairbanks since 1994. National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Bogel says the official temperature at the airport reached 91 degrees.
It broke the old record of 88, which was set back in 1968. It was a very unusually warm air mass.
The high temperature ended the longest span in years since record-keeping began in 1904, during which Fairbanks didn't hit 90 degrees or above. Yesterday's high reading capped a week of 80-plus temperature days in Fairbanks, the warmest 7 days since the record wildfire summer of 2004. Tanana and Delta Junction also had new daily temperature records Wednesday, with readings in the mid-80s. A cold front that pushed into the interior last night brought wind, thunderstorms, and cooler temperatures, but Bogel says it will only provide a temporary break from hot, dry weather.
There is a large ridge of high pressure that's been a fairly persistent feature this month, and it's expected to rebuild across the area this weekend, and that will push temperatures back up into the 80s.
Bogel says last night's thunderstorms resulted in 3,500 lightning strikes in an area from Galena to Fairbanks and between the Alaska Range and Tanana. He says the thunderstorms produced up to an inch of rain in some spots, but that there was also some dry lightning. Fairbanks Area State Fire Management Officer Robert Schmall says that could result in new wildfire starts as the weather dries out in coming days.
They might smolder, and then as soon as it heats up again, they'll take off on you. We call those holdover fires, and so you continue to fly detection and try and pick them up before things dry out again too much.
A new wildfire started 20 miles southwest of Fairbanks yesterday. The fire north of the park's highway drew a major aerial and ground suppression effort and received some rain overnight. More than 40 firefighters are on scene trying to contain the blaze.
Thank you.
A special session may be on the horizon for state lawmakers, in addition to a possible override of Governor Palin's veto of federal economic stimulus funds. Lawmakers may also weigh in on her latest choice to be the incoming lieutenant governor, KTOO's Matt Miller reports.
Corrections Commissioner Joe Schmidt doesn't want to be the new lieutenant governor. He says he sent a letter to Governor Sarah Palin Tuesday afternoon resigning as the lieutenant governor designee. That could clear the way for Palin's most recent nominee, Lieutenant General Craig Campbell. A member of the cabinet is usually named as lieutenant governor designee in case the position ever becomes vacant. In this case, as Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell succeeds outgoing Governor Palin. After the departure of Attorney General Talis Kohlberg, Schmidt became the second executive in waiting.
Sure, an honor to be asked to do that, and an even bigger honor, really, to be confirmed by the legislature to do it, thinking, of course, it was going to be an emergent-type situation. And, you know, there was no elections coming. I certainly didn't think anyone would resign their post. And, you know, going in an emergency situation was one thing, but this was planned, you know, and it just felt a little bit different to me.
Schmidt says Palin's resignation took him completely by surprise, but for him, he says there are too many things at corrections that he'd like to see through, from new prison construction to an audit of in-state facilities and renewal of a contract for out-of-state prisoners. Oversight of the State Division of Elections is one of the primary duties of the lieutenant governor. Schmidt says he also thought that assuming that position might appear inappropriate.
Sometimes there's reports that the governor and I went to school together and these kinds of things, and as untrue as that sort of thing is, it is a perception, and I think that perception may cause a person in my situation to fight for credibility in, you know, in a position that I was not elected into. And meanwhile, like I said, leaving corrections behind raised some concerns with me, and I expressed those. So.
State lawyers still trying to sift through the Constitution and state law on the line of succession and the correct process in this unique instance.
Yeah, although I'm not going to give you much more detail than we're working on it.
Deputy Attorney General Craig Tillery says it's still unclear how their analysis will come out, although Schmidt stepping aside clears things up a bit.
If you're going to have Mr. Campbell or General Campbell become the designee, you can't have two designees or appointees at the same time. So one of them, I mean, in order for Mr. Campbell to come in, Mr. Schmidt would have to have vacated the position. So, yes, that makes the analysis, it's just a necessary step if that's what's going to happen.
The big unknown is whether it can be considered a recess appointment. That is, Campbell assuming office without the legislature meeting to confirm that appointment.
Quite clearly, he could be appointed successor, but whether prior to confirmation, if there were a vacancy, he could then succeed to the position, that is sort of the question.
The state constitution lays out the framework for succession in the executive branch, while state statute appears to require the legislature weighing in with a confirmation vote. That happened with Schmidt's appointment in April, but not for Lieutenant General Craig Campbell. Campbell, as head of the Alaska National Guard and commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, was named by Governor Palin during her resignation announcement July 3rd. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jay Ramirez says they've invited Campbell to appear before the committee in Fairbanks July 20th. That's less than a week before Sean Parnell takes the oath of office. In a printed statement, Ramirez says they're stepping in to bring order to the constitutional chaos Palin created. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
The man President Obama has chosen to run the Bureau of Land Management faced questions from the Senate Energy Committee today. Robert Abbey's confirmation hearing focused on balancing development and conservation efforts on public lands. Abbey said he is a proponent of multiple use.
Certainly not every acre managed by the Bureau of Land Management is appropriate for oil and gas leasing. Not every acre managed by the Bureau of Land Management is suitable for wilderness designations. The best place to address multiple use on public lands is through the very public land use planning process so that you can work through the potential conflicts and come out with the best decisions and giving the opportunity for the public to play a role in that decision process.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is the Energy Committee's top Republican and questioned what Abbey would do to speed up land conveyances to the state of Alaska and Alaska Native groups. They're supposed to conclude by the end of this year, but Murkowski says only about half are finalized. At the time of statehood, Alaska was promised 104 million acres of land, and Alaska Natives were additionally promised 44 million acres when they settled land claims in 1971. Abbey said he believes it will happen by the end of the year.
The Bureau of Land Management in Alaska has stated that they are on track to meet their commitments by December 2009. So if you know of something that's different than that, I would certainly appreciate hearing about it, and I will do everything that I can, once confirmed, to work with you to make sure that the Bureau of Land Management focuses the appropriate attention to resolving these lands actions and move forward aggressively to meet those commitments.
Also today, the Energy Committee heard from President's nominee for Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management, Wilma Lewis. Senator Murkowski asked Lewis how she would prioritize Alaska interests. The senator pointed out that 61% of the country's wilderness lands are in Alaska, and nearly 40% of all National Park Service land is within the state.
So you'd think that if you're looking at the percentages of the pie, we would get a greater percentage of DOI budget, but it turns out that there's just barely a couple percent of DOI budget that's spent on managing Alaska holdings.
Lewis told Murkowski she couldn't answer that until she was in the job and had a chance to look at the entire budget. The two agreed to talk about it at greater length. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Assembly approves an ordinance giving police the right to remove illegal campsites.
Right now, we have a public safety issue, and the public safety issue has to be dealt with.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has lifted a 2006 injunction against the Kensington Mine. It puts the mine one step closer to constructing a tailings facility, the last major work to be done before operations can begin. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision reversed a 2007 Ninth Circuit ruling that the mine's tailings permit violated the Clean Water Act. That permit allows Kensington to deposit mine waste into Lower Slate Lake. Mine owners Core Alaska last week asked the Ninth Circuit to immediately dissolve the injunction, which halted work on the tailings dam 3 years ago. The company told the lower court that more delays could cost millions of dollars and push the production start date well into 2011. With the injunction lifted, the company is looking forward to construction on a tailings plant. Company spokesman Tony Ebersole says about 300 people will be hired to build it.
We would expect the timely reactivation of our 404 permits from the Corps of Engineers now that the injunction is dissolved. In terms of the timing, there have been some jobs posted already. You know, this obviously will help facilitate, you know, our moving ahead. And, you know, we are still looking to target production at the mine in the second half of next year.
Randy Wanamaker of Burners Bay Consortium, which is focused on preparing workers for mining jobs, says he's been fielding calls from all over the U.S. since the Supreme Court decision.
We have a special emphasis on people who are from Southeast Alaska that either live here now or move to some other part of the state or move outside of state and want to return home, because they're already acclimated. They know what the weather's like. They know what the living conditions are like.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it is now reviewing the company's tailings permit, which expired last year while the company was ensnared in the legal challenge. The Anchorage police have a new tool to deal with illegal campsites in the city. KSKA's Len Anderson reports on a new law passed at this week's Anchorage Assembly meeting.
Anchorage police now have the authority to take down illegal campsites after a 12-hour notice period. And if no one is present, the officer may dispose of all items as abandoned waste. The Anchorage Assembly approved the ordinance Tuesday evening, but only after a lengthy discussion that began with a public hearing. 10 people spoke to the issue. Most had actually come for the public hearing on the sexual orientation proposal. But David Dunsworth said the short notice for the campsites had attracted his attention and concern.
This is not a solution. This isn't even really a band-aid to the problem. Why we have people illegally camping is because we have more homeless in the city than our city's support network is able to possibly deal with.
Others from the public pretty much agreed.
My name's Kenneth Anderson. I feel compelled to just ask you to be compassionate on the homeless. They need your compassion. They don't need to be bullied like this.
My name's Susan Klein, and I also didn't plan on speaking on this, but I saw it on the agenda. Personally, I think we should, instead of having illegal camping, make campsites for homeless.
Don Barnhart testified that he'd worked with the homeless for 10 years, and many were not involved with alcohol or drugs. He described a woman with 3 children who was discovered camped in a downtown alley. Some on the assembly wondered if they should delay action on the ordinance, at least until after a panel and public discussion on homelessness takes place this Friday. Others suggested waiting to September. Assemblymember Dan Coffey disagreed with delay. He said the 12-hour rule for illegal campsites was not directed at homeless families.
I believe one of the things we have a right to is our public facilities. I don't want to go to Campbell Park to play on that nice little ball field over there with my family and have to deal with the campers and the drunks and the bums laying around. I don't think it's appropriate. And this ordinance addresses a very small part of it. It allows enforcement and protection of public spaces.
That's what we're dealing with here with our homeless chronic inebriates. The foundation is addiction, but many of whom choose to live in those camps and live along those bike trails.
Anchorage Police Chief Rob Hewn had been brought forward to explain what portion of the city's homeless population the law was directed at and if it really was needed so quickly.
Right now, we have a public safety issue, and the public safety issue has to be dealt with. I need some tools in my toolbox for my officers to implement.
Hewn said that the 12 or 24 hours was not as important as simply establishing a set limit. The current situation was absorbing too much officer time.
A lot of times you get back to these camps, you've got to maneuver overland, find the camps. You find the camps, they're usually a mess, they're usually a health hazard. You got to stay there if you're going to tell the people to leave, and it takes time.
Chief Hewn said dealing with the city's illegal camps should not fall solely to his department.
If it's more than a public safety problem, it wants to be embraced as a social services, public health, and criminal justice problem, then we have to take step back and take a deep breath and commit to do something with the state. You got to partner with the state. This is a statewide problem. Most of the folks in these camps have only been in Anchorage for 1 or 2 years.
That step back in part takes place tomorrow, Friday, when the Anchorage Community Police Relations Task Force, the Alaska Native Justice Center, and the Municipality of Anchorage's Office of Equal Opportunity are holding a public forum and panel discussion on homelessness in Anchorage. The event takes place at the Fairview Recreation Center from noon to 2 p.m. This is Len Anderson.
Fairbanks police have a new way of keeping alcohol out of the hands of chronic inebriates. The city council passed an ordinance this week that makes it a finable offense to buy alcohol for chronic drinkers. Police Chief Laren Zager says the proxy buying provision is just another means to chip away at a big problem.
You know, if a storekeeper phones it in and says, hey, I just sold some beer to a guy and I notice he's going right out to the group on the street, the inebriates on the street, and they're passing it out, we can respond to that. I just don't want people to think it's going to revolutionize the Western world. It is just another tool.
Zager says the law will be hard to enforce and does not include any funding for new officers to watch liquor stores and other alcohol sellers. The city council passed the law after stripping a controversial provision that would have prevented sale of alcohol to people that police have repeatedly picked up for chronic intoxication. Councilmember Jerry Cleworth says the idea of creating and enforcing a no-sell list gave rise to concerns during a city council meeting Monday.
If we can get over some of the questions of possible litigation of the list and confidentiality and penalties associated with it, and we might be able to come up with something that there is a useful tool an establishment can have.
City Attorney Herb Cuss says people have no inherent right to buy alcohol, and the government has the authority to regulate its sale. But an inebriates list would have to be handled carefully.
The problem with creating a list where basically you're labeled as an inebriate is that's not something that government can simply willy-nilly publish in the domain without incurring some potential liability with defamation and invasion of privacy.
Chronic inebriate list laws are employed to stop sales in some communities, including Santa Cruz, California.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
The Saddler's Ultra Challenge is coming back. The world's longest wheelchair and hand cycle race, normally run between Fairbanks and Anchorage on the Parks Highway, is celebrating its 25th year with a new format. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The popular July event was noticeably absent from its traditional route along the Parks Highway last summer. Organizers promised that the race's cancellation was to prepare for something bigger and better to celebrate the Ultra Challenge's 25th year. Renamed the Alaska Challenge, the 2009 race will take place in Prince William Sound, Copper Basin, and Mat-Su Valley communities. Race co-director Heather Plazinski says the new route reflects several factors, including safety.
We wanted to increase the number of racers that we could accept, and traditionally, logistically, we've paired one pilot car per racer. And on the Parks Highway, it's been increasingly getting more traffic, and so that's where we started to hatch a plan to get away from the Parks Highway and do something different.
The race will cover courses in Seward, Cordova, Thompson Pass, Lake Louise, and Hatcher Pass, and features a mix of time trials and road stages ranging from 10 to 55 miles and 16,000 feet of vertical. The race website refers to the event as the Tour de France of wheelchair sports and the only multi-day timed stage race in the world for hand cyclists and wheelchair racers. Plazinski says a field of 37 racers, the most ever, includes several past Ultra Challenge and Olympic champions.
Pretty much every single Beijing gold medalist for the U.S. anyway. So the field's very strong, and of course we still have the international flair. We have racers from Austria, Germany, South Africa.
Eight Alaskans are on the roster, including Larry Kudermarsh of North Pole, the race's longest-running participant. Kudermarsh has competed in 22 past Alaska Challenge races, 17 more than anyone else. Kudermarsh says the race is a big part of his life.
It's the one thing I dream of throughout the year. And I've never won, but I've done well.
Kudermarsh got involved in the race after being severely injured when he was hit by a car in Fairbanks back in 1985. He says that's when he connected with one of the event's co-founders.
There were two guys, Don Brandon and Tommy Carnahan, decided to show awareness for disabled people and decided, well, let's just push our wheelchairs from Fairbanks to Anchorage. And then that went on 2 years. And then Don Brandon actually saw me get hit by the car that hit me. He came visit me in the hospital, told me about the race, and then that year I got in shape and I started in a regular hospital wheelchair because I had no clue there was such thing as racing wheelchairs. And then somebody during the race loaned me their spare wheelchair, their racer, and I pulled third that year.
Kudermarsh's name is synonymous with the Alaska Challenge race. He acts as a consultant for organizers and says he's made many friends through the event over the years. He's so dedicated, he even raced solo when struggling organizers threatened to cancel the event in 1996.
They said, we'll try to do it next year, and I knew it would never happen. So I got in my racing wheelchair and did it solo. And Dave Cavett, who owns Saddlers, saw me on the news and saw what a great thing it was, and so he sponsored the race with the big bucks every year since.
Kudermarsh, now 48 years old, says he's gotten faster over the last two decades, but so has everyone else in the race. He says equipment innovations, most notably the development of the hand cycle, which many participants, including Kudermarsh, now use, have changed the sport. Hand cycles have gears like bicycles, which riders crank with their hands to travel faster. Kudermarsh says he's been working hard to prepare for the 25th anniversary Alaska Challenge. using an indoor trainer last winter and getting up at 2:30 in the morning to practice on the road this summer. Brant Schalk of Fairbanks has also been putting in big training miles. The 28-year-old Schalk says he has high ambitions.
Fastest Alaskan. We did a time trial a couple of weeks ago. It was 23 miles, and I got second place. So I'm in a good situation, I think.
It'll only be Schalk's second time running the Alaska race and third year competing. He says racing in the Challenge opened his eyes to how tough and fit wheelchair and hand cycle racers are and inspired him to get better. The Saddler's Alaska Challenge starts July 19th in Seward and wraps up on the 26th in Palmer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Many people use prepaid calling cards instead of long-distance phone service because it is cheaper. But Alaskans recently found out that they could no longer recharge their prepaid Sprint cards. They complained about it, and now the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is looking into the accusations. For Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Alice Criswell reports.
Sprint cards are now under the company STI. When that takeover happened, STI stopped further card services to Alaskans. Grace Salazar, spokesperson for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, says under federal communications law, STI may not discriminate against one state by stopping recharge practices.
Sprint has a contract with the customers to provide services at 2.83 cents per minute. And when STI took over, they wanted to stop providing service here in Alaska but continue services in other states. And now STI wants to stop allowing Alaskan consumers to recharge the cards at that rate. They're not allowing consumers to recharge it at any rate at all.
STI assumed responsibility for the Sprint prepaid calling cards in September of 2008. In February of this year, the RCA started receiving consumer complaints about the situation. STI did not return calls to KYUK in time for this newscast. Salazar explains what the RCA has heard from the phone company.
Well, I can't speak for STI, but it's my understanding that they believe it's too expensive to provide service here in Alaska.
She says the commission issued an order asking STI to allow Alaskan consumers to recharge their cards while the RCA investigates this matter. However, STI did not follow that order. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Miller and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Alice Criswell in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.